Welcome to the Space Cave, a big warg to all of you. I am David Huntsberger, your host, broadcasting from the nether regions of deep space. Old business, well, perhaps new business, Bob Denver died years ago, and I mentioned it in the last episode that he was among those who had passed recently. I could have just not mentioned that and let it seem like it was sort of a joke I had slipped in there. I genuinely saw an article and thought, he died a while ago. Gotta trust the internet. Guess Bob Denver just died. And then I said it aloud, and only Penny was nice enough to write me and say, hey, dude, the internet got ya. So apologies for that. And also, what's going on with the rest of you? Only Penny kind enough to give me the heads up on that. I like our little community we're building. It's been nice to chat with you and hear from you in various outlets, I guess? I don't know. Anyway, I like our group, Spaceburgers. And I think you've landed on that name. I'll stick with that as long as you're comfortable with it. So big news, you guys. Huge news. We live in a different solar system than we potentially did a few days or weeks or years or millennia ago. We are part of the few who are alive for 9 planets and then sadly got to see or had to see Pluto taken away. And then now there's a chance we're back to 9, a full squad, so say a couple fellas at Caltech. So I wanted to find out more about that, called my resident planetary expert, planetary exploration guru, first guest ever on the podcast, first person in the Space Cave, Matthew Wielicki. You might know him as Matthew Wielicki. And here's my chat with him to find out more about Planet 9.
Hello?
Matthew, it's David Huntsberger.
Hey, David, how's it going?
Good, how are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Nice, did you get your baby to sleep?
He is down.
Excellent. How's he doing?
That was always, it's going good. We're just actually in Fresno visiting my folks. I grew up in Fresno.
About a year ago, I did a tour with the band Pinback, and it was my first time ever performing in Fresno, and I thought it was quite nice.
Oh yeah, I call it the armpit of California.
I think people look negatively at it, and I certainly went into
it.
Yeah, because the three strikes rule in California originated from a murder there, right?
Oh man, I don't even know that. Is that true?
Yeah, there was like a meth guy who went up and shot this girl because he didn't like the way she was looking at him, and then so her dad
I do recall. No, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I always associate Fresno as just kind of twitchy, methy people with like really nothing to do.
That's probably pretty accurate.
No way, man! You're from there.
Yeah, I guess there's a little enclave of North Fresno that's kind of a nice area.
If you go into Fresno, go to North Fresno. It's the better part of the city.
Yeah, Clovis is nice.
Oh, yeah. Clovis, they do, when I was in the roping world, there's a big roping in Clovis. That's kind of
yeah, that's very cowboy, yeah. Fresno's really it's an ag town.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the majority of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
There's a university. But
that's right, yeah, the Bulldogs.
That's right, that's all our folks teach.
It's weird, no one ever romanticizes about Fresno as a quaint college town, and yet it could be.
No. Yeah, it's big though, there's like 500,000 people.
Oh yeah, that's right, yeah, it's deceptively gigantic.
Yeah, it's big, it's really big.
Well, speaking of big, you're my go-to guy. New planet getting discovered. What do you think about it? What do you think about Planet X? Or not Planet X, Planet yeah, 9,
Planet
sorry.
Planet 9. It's a strange thing to be asked that a planet was discovered, when really nothing's actually been discovered.
Yeah, it's just math, right? You know,
there's some math that they did. So, I mean, it's clever. This is when science does something clever with models and math, and it gets run away with, and next thing you know, it's planets are discovered, but nothing, no observations have been made. They found these objects out in space, past Pluto, and they found the 7 of them. One of them is called Sedna, and these little things are flying out there, and they noticed that 7 of them had their closest approach to the sun that happened to be really like close to each other, and they're like, what? That's kind of weird. Why would that happen? And they tried to figure out the probability of that, and it's some really small number, 0.000-something%. They're like, well, something has to be out there helping these things or herding these things into, like, a similar orbit.
Yeah, the thing I saw about that was, or that I was reading, was that the Kuiper Belt, is that those 7 things? That's what that's called?
That's right. So those are 7 of, there are 7 objects of thousands of objects that are out in the Kuiper Belt.
They
happen to be 7 pretty big ones.
Yeah, okay.
But it's really far away, and it's really hard to see. We don't have a good handle on the number of objects that are flying around out there.
It just seemed like...
But they made some calculations to figure out how big would the thing have to be in order to herd these 7 objects into making a similar orbit.
Oh,
and they come
I see.
Up with something around the size of Neptune.
Because I was...
That's huge.
Yeah. The way I was reading it was, I thoroughly don't understand gravity and how we are orbiting and the sun has a pull on us and this giant planet would stay within an orbit, however enormously elliptical it is, where it's 10,000 years or what have you. And then it plows through the Kuiper Belt, it moves these things around, but not enough to send them out of the way or draw them to it to like become moons of it. It just moves them out of the way as if like, excuse me, guys, coming through, and orbits through them, and then they move back like, hey, no problem, man, and just get right back to where they... Is that kind of what's happening?
It's you could think of it like it's perturbing their orbit.
Yeah, but
that
doesn't make sense to me. I think like I just don't understand gravity. It just bothers their orbit, but it doesn't send them out and it doesn't attract them to a degree where they're like experiencing the gravity of this enormous planet.
That's right. Well, so it is experiencing it. It's just not. It's not experiencing it such that it's going to get pulled into the body.
I see. Okay. Okay.
So it's just clipping it enough that it's getting a little bit of excitation into its orbit, and it's getting perturbed, but not enough to actually get sucked in to the planet. So Jupiter has a ton of these asteroids that are basically herded by it. We call them these Trojan asteroids, and it's basically these bodies are just out there, and their orbits are getting messed with by Jupiter's gravitational pull, but not enough that it's going to get pulled in, but enough that they kind of exist in a weird spot that we wouldn't expect to see a lot of these things. They're kind of assigning the same logic to this outer 7 objects.
They
kind of found it all orbiting together. Why would they do that? Maybe there's another big body out there that's actually hurting the objects.
So do you believe that it is a planet, or you just think like it's convenient math, or it's kind of cleverness?
It's clever math. I mean, I think it's gonna spur on a lot of people to go looking, which is exciting. I wouldn't be surprised if there was a lot of other objects out past Pluto. I would be very surprised if they were the size of Neptune.
yeah, that's
usually,
what seems the
you know,
strangest. It's so big.
Planets kind of get bigger. Mars gets a little smaller, and that's because of Jupiter's pull. Mars and then the asteroid belt. The asteroid belt was probably a planet that was trying to form and got ripped apart because Jupiter was being such a bully with its gravitational pull. It didn't allow all those little pieces to come together.
Yeah. Okay.
And then they get smaller as you go out all the way to Pluto. And so just to have them jump up again to the size of Neptune would be strange to me.
Yeah,
it's going to spur on a lot of good science.
Well, that's cool. I mean, but it's too far away for someone like you to get involved and get a look at the chemistry of it or get a sample or anything like that, right?
It would be tough to say that a meteorite that's on Earth came from an object that far away.
Damn. Yeah, I don't yeah. get it. Because if that's happened, and I think we think of the orbits like when you drop those coins into that swirly thing and it...
You can, yeah, it is kind of like that. But think of it like... think of it instead of a coin on a hard piece of plastic, think of it like a marble rolling around on a cloth stretched out.
Like yeah.
You know, Lycra. But that, it has its own divot.
But that
every body has its own gravitational divot.
And a black hole is if you, like, grab that Lycra and pulled it way down.
Way, way down. But the sun, in our case, the sun is in the middle of ours.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all going around it. And the Earth has its own divot, and the moon's in that divot.
Right.
And going around happily, you know. And then Jupiter has its own real big divot. And it's messing with a lot of other objects. And their idea is that there's another planet way out there that has its own other big divot.
And the Lycra is on a plane. Is that a simplistic
exactly.
view?
Exactly.
But space isn't...
The Lycra's
isn't
on a plane. That is simplistic because the idea is that Pluto itself, one of the reasons it rejected it out of its planet category, is because of its plane is not very aligned with the ecliptic, which is basically the planar line that goes through the center of the sun and comes right with the orbits of most of the planets.
I see. Okay.
And most of the planets are a few degrees from that.
I see. So there
Pluto
is...
Pluto has some weird inclined orbit.
It has to be kind of on this, so quote-unquote, kind of Lycra plane. We're not going to find things like, oh, it turns out there was something orbiting around us perpendicular to that for ages, and we just didn't notice it.
Yeah, the idea is that when the solar system's forming, it comes down and makes a disk.
Ah, okay.
Everything kind of collapses into like a disk shape, and then the sun is forming in the middle, and then all the planets are kind of forming around. So you have some variation there. Things can get messed with and get on weird orbits.
Yeah, time is a flat black
get
circle,
into gravitational
man.
Resonances.
It's a flat disk. Well, we got to get you back in the actual cave and talk more about this stuff, because this is...
Yeah, for sure.
But this clears it up for me pretty good. I appreciate it, man. Thanks for taking a few minutes and checking in and enlightening everybody. What would you name it? I know, like, David Bowie passes away a few days later. They find this new planet. Why don't they just call it Planet Bowie?
I would be all for it. I'm on board. I doubt there's going to be a name until somebody actually says they, like, see something that they, you know, they think they can find or they can assign to, like, a planet. Because it's pretty far out there, so it's going to be hard to see something that far out.
Yeah.
I mean, and, like you said, its orbit's, like, 10,000 years to make 1 year.
So yeah, I mean...
summer's, like, 4,000 years long, you know?
Yeah, 4,000.
Isn't that crazy?
It's like Game of Thrones. It's a long one.
Right.
All right, man. Well, enjoy Fresno, and hope to see you back when you're in Los Angeles.
For sure, David. Thanks, man.
Cool, yeah. Good talking with you, Matthew. See ya.
All right. Have a good night.
You too. Bye. Yeah. So, unbridled enthusiasm. Potentially there's a planet out there. Could just be clever math. Who knows? But hopefully get Matthew back in the cave at some point and chat with him more. Really enjoy chatting with him. And I don't know if that makes you feel better or worse. Or I like the idea of a Planet Bowie. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. Anyway, that'll all sort itself out. We'll be glued to our television screens and radios and podcasts and any other avenue we can possibly glean information from. Anyway, let's get into it, you guys. My guest is via Skype this week, and he is also the person who compiles these episodes and makes them sound so wonderful. And so it probably won't sound as terrible as some Skype calls do, because he also recorded himself on the other end from Australia. He is the engineer of this show, a huge comedy fan, and just an all-around nice guy, and a weirdo, a genuine weirdo, which I appreciate. You see a lot of affectations where people are trying to be weird. I find Dan to just be delightfully weird and very enjoyable. So he raises fish and is trying to develop new species of guppy. I may potentially have one named after me down the road. Who knows? We'll find out all about it. Anything you want to know about fish, we're going to learn with my guest this week, Dan Pritchard.
Dan Pritchard.
How are you, mate?
Good. How you doing, buddy? We're yeah, the sound quality is pretty good on my end. How is it over there?
Really good. I've disabled all Wi-Fi. What's been happening this week?
What has been happening? Well, I've been working on some stuff for the junk show and doing some writing. How about yourself?
Working hard, not doing any writing, which I feel horrible about. What can you do? There's only so many hours in the day.
Mm-hmm. Are you fiddling with knobs?
You can tell it's the voice, isn't it?
Yeah, you seem...
Yeah, so I'm just turning off the Wi-Fi on my mobile.
Oh, okay. Man, you're really getting extraneous signals out of the room.
Yeah, I've just got the cat here. That he's not, one of the cats, but he's not digital, so I'm not expecting any interference.
Okay, well, as long as
unless souls are real.
I don't know what that means. Unless what's are real?
Souls.
Souls. Oh, his soul. He has a wireless soul?
Yeah. Well, I haven't seen any wires coming out of him to God.
I got to meet this little cat with a wireless soul.
Well, he's got so much soul.
And your soul is a landline. It's tied to a physical something.
Yeah. Not funny story about that. Twice I've rang up to say, I don't need a landline anymore. Rang up my phone service provider and say, hey, let's cut off this landline. They say, but you do want the internet, don't you? I said, oh, yeah. Twice I've done that. Not once, but twice.
I thought that was funnier than you gave it credit for.
Yeah, well, you know, I tried to be a rock star for 10 years, so maybe that done some damage.
Yeah, I'm sure I mentioned it like in the intro to this portion of our chat that you are in Australia and we're chatting over Skype. This is the first time I've done this as far as the for the podcast. Everyone else, and we're not drinking beer because it's like noon my time. Not that that always prohibits me, but it just feels a little strange to kick off the day with doing that. So we're no beer for this podcast, and you are, what time is it there?
It's 6:53 a.m.
Whew, got up real early to do the Space Cave. All right. Well, thanks for getting up.
Going Space Cave crazy over here.
I want to get into who you are, how you came to be. You compile and I guess engineer is probably the right way to say it for Space Cave episodes. But you're not in the room. You organize them and whatever you apply your tricks after the fact to make it sound all good. And then you were a listener and fan of Professor Blastoff before that, and then more so just seemingly into just comedy as a whole. So how'd you get to be so enamored with comedy overall?
Wow, geez. Well, I guess it was my father, because he's British, or he was British. He came over to Australia when he was 19, and I guess he just still loved British things. Because he was only a boy, really, when he came over, right? So, you know, we had to watch all the British sitcoms. And I mean all of them. Anything that the Aussie TV would have on that was a British sitcom, we would watch it, good, bad, or indifferent. So I guess that really got ingrained in me. And then when I discovered Monty Python sort of 10 years after the fact, or 15 years after the fact, and then, you know, got right into Monty Python. And then after that, it was comedy of the 80s, a little bit after the fact, normally 2-3 years, the young ones. And then I was off after that. I didn't need much more after that. It was just whatever was happening at the time.
But, I mean, you seem, not that Australia is isolated, and especially with the internet, but you're up on things that would seemingly be kind of hard to find. Bizarre, you know, even just podcasts, especially a few years ago, weren't all that well known, and you knew all of them. And then calling in to like The Best Show, and I don't know, it just seems like you're up on everything that comes out. How do you stay up to speed with everything?
Well, you know, thank God our evil overlords, Google and YouTube, are as good as their jobs as they are, because that little suggestion feed on the right hand side of YouTube. I discovered a fantastic comedian the other day, a British one this time, called Richard Herring, that I'd seen once on a British panel show and thought, oh, God, he's interesting. And it turns out he's 100-something episodes deep into a video and audio podcast. And so, you know, there's a new guy. So that one was from YouTube. It wouldn't talk about Professor Blastoff. First of all, Tig on Comedy Bang Bang, mm-hmm. Just mentioned Kyle and Dunnigan together. Mm-hmm. I thought, Kyle Dunnigan, oh. And she was obviously, you know, really, he was a friend of Tig's. That's all I knew. So I looked up Kyle. So when Professor Blastoff came, I knew Tig, I knew Kyle. I was soon to know a sweet baby David Huntsberger very well.
And sweet baby so Dave, that's
I mentally jot these things down, and then instead of forgetting about them, I chase them up.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I do differently, maybe from, but all comedy fans do that. I know they do, because I talk to them all the time.
Yeah, you guys have started like a little online community of, I guess it is different than, you know, how where you, before you maybe would wait outside a venue or send a letter to like a fan club, and now you can just tweet right at the person or even email them. And I think that makes it, I don't know, I have this impression of like entertainers of old, you know, coming home and someone going, you've got your fan bag here, this bag full of letters, and they go, meh. And then maybe I'll get to them. And they were considered a great person if they sat down and wrote back to like 1% of those letters. I'll bet now people, you know, just a quick tweet back to someone or even retweeting it. I see that from time to time. People that are pretty big, you know, someone will tweet at them, hey, it's my birthday, and they'll retweet that. Or so I guess it is a lot more communal now. There isn't this, people don't live in these palaces or towers removed from society. They're totally reachable.
That's right. But what isn't reachable is actual palaces and towers. Because of the internet and file sharing, there isn't the same sort of money in the recording business as there used to be.
What? You're crazy.
So, you know, you might consider a retweet might end up in $20 worth of sales. So it's definitely worthwhile doing. I mean, that's, you know, that might sound callous, but I, you know, I couldn't see any reason for people like Jerry Seinfeld or stuff like that to do that occasional stuff.
Yeah.
If it wasn't good business, because he is a very good businessman, apart from a very good comedian.
So we've established that you are a major comedy fan, probably the biggest, one of the biggest ones I know, and you make funny videos. You'll send them to me from time to time. They're so bizarre and weird. I always get a kick out of,
ooh,
of that.
There goes my alarm. Stop that.
Oh, yep. Yeah. Get that alarm settled away. Man, you had all your Wi-Fi things turned off, and then that stupid analog alarm ended up being the downfall. You referenced Sweet Baby Dave. That was a guinea pig that is named after me, right?
Oh, yeah. He was a cute little guy. I breed guinea pigs on and off over the past 10 years or so. This little guy, he came out, he was like a Rex guinea pig, like a wire-haired little guy. Just, he was the runt of the litter. I mean, not that you are, Dave. I know you're
How dare
average.
You?
You're average.
I'm the middle of the litter.
It wasn't the middle of the litter, but this little guy was the runt of the litter, so I thought, oh, let's have a bit of fun. And these things take no time at all, and I think they, you know, the performers that I send them to, they generally get a lot of pleasure out of them. It's a bit of fun. There's never mean-spirited stuff or anything in there. As you say, it's always weird. So I continue to do them from time to time.
Okay. Well, if I ever get down to that part of the world, I'll, and the guinea pig is still living, I'd love to come by and say hello, maybe pet it even.
Yeah, he went to a very good breeder.
Oh.
So he went out to be a stud.
That a boy. I knew he would. From the runt to the top stud. Stud guinea pig.
There's a very good chance he's still alive because they the guinea pigs don't suffer the same sort of diseases that the rabbits do in Australia, no? Because we're actively trying to stamp out rabbits.
Really?
With viruses. Yeah, your rabbits are a really big problem in out in wild Australia.
I did not know that. Yeah. So I thought the frogs, like from that Simpsons episode, I thought frogs getting introduced had harmful effects to the ecosystem, but it's rabbits?
Rabbits, foxes. Oh God, I have so much trouble with the urban foxes in the backyard here. Got one of my stud rabbits chasing the neighborhood cats. I know you have still have nightmares about coyotes eating your cats or taking.
Yeah, I hate them.
So coyotes, but at least they're native to your country. You know, like the foxes, they're feral. We don't like them.
Ah, you got to root them out of there.
Yeah, I've had a few run-ins with the local urban foxes.
Describe, like, how so? What do you mean by run-ins?
Oh, well, we got a bit of a little battle going. I was just moving around in my bedroom one evening just with the light off. I know that territory pretty well. I just went in to grab something. And out the window, I saw something running across the backyard that looked exactly like a fox running across the backyard. So I thought, oh, that'll be a fox. You know, I put that together pretty easily. So I
you saw
went
a fox
to the window and looked
then
out just to see a fox, chasing one of the neighbor cats across the road. And I thought, oh, God, this isn't going to stand. So I said, oh, where's Super Hands? You know, one of my cats, because he normally stays out at night. So I went outside, found him pretty quickly, thankfully, literally chucked him inside. And I thought, well, I've got to do something about this fox, because as I watched it, it was chasing then a bunch of kittens, probably feral kittens, but anyway, up and down the street and around some buildings, commercial buildings. And I thought, oh, my goodness, this is I can't have this, but I don't know whether I want to take on a fox one-on-one, especially when it's this hungry.
Wait, but this fox couldn't even kill a little kitten.
Well, these are like four-month kittens.
Still, I mean, you're quite a bit bigger. I bet you your chances are pretty good.
Yes, but in the heat of the moment, I thought, oh, this fox is pretty hungry. It might be rabid, and there's only me. So what I'd done is got in my car, got a pitchfork, a long-handled pitchfork, got in the car and tried to corral it into a corner of two buildings, and where I was going to, you know, do what comes naturally to
rabbit.
Which
is stab a fox with a pitchfork?
I mean, it's not something that I would ever choose, to do, but obviously this animal's in a lot of pain.
The most natural thing in the world. Are you talking about stabbing a fox with a pitchfork? Okay, so you're gonna murder this fox.
But he escaped.
Ah, dang
and
it.
And then went into a car lot across the road. I ran over there with my fork, and there was a guy just closing up. And I said, hey, there's a rabbit fox in here. And he said, what? And
I've diagnosed it as rabid.
I know it sounds weird.
And you had there's really no reason to think the fox is rabid other than it makes you seem a little tougher. Where you're like, there's a rabid fox over here.
It was acting very unusually. Normally when a fox even just sees you, it runs a mile.
Oh, I see. You know? Okay. So yeah, it had some rabid symptoms.
Yeah, it looked all mangy and when it saw me, it wasn't actively running away. It was actively still trying to chase these cats that it had herded even. Mm-hmm. Because the neighbor cat didn't have kittens. It's lived over there for 12 years, you know, at least. Yeah, it doesn't have kittens.
They always say people will say, oh, it's like herding cats, as if it's difficult. And that yet this fox had figured out a way to do it. Maybe you stumbled upon a special fox.
Well, it was as cunning as a fox. Mm-hmm. As cunning as a fox has just got a certificate of cunning from Oxford University. Blackadder, old comedy show.
Oh, were you referencing something?
Yeah, that's right.
Whew, you missed me with that one. But I got the Super Hands reference. We've talked about that, though. You love Peep Show.
Yeah, everyone loves Peep Show.
Yeah, it's great. So how did you, your dad's British, how'd you end up in Australia?
Well, Dad's British, Mum's from the Netherlands, i.e. Dutch. So there wasn't much happening at the end of the war. In Britain, had austerity measures for, you know, 20, 30 years after the war. It was dead, dead broke. So Dad's parents said, you know, get the heck out of here. There isn't much happening. Go to Australia. They've got a deal on, like £10 to get to Australia, very small amount of money. So he just turned up in Australia just with a mob of other migrants, British migrants. Hmm. And, you know, and he just done farm labouring until he became a psychiatric nurse.
Oh, so he wasn't a guinea pig man. You didn't, like, go into the family business.
No. But Mum come over with sort of half of her family because the Netherlands was occupied by the Nazis, and they got kicked out of their house and sort of kicked around. I mean, they weren't Jewish. Oh, we're not Jewish. So we were spared that catastrophe. But, yeah, it had a pretty bad time. And so my opa, which is Dutch for grandfather, he had a very sour taste in his mouth about Europe after that. So he said, let's get the hell out of here. You know, let's go to Australia and see what's happening. So they jumped on back in those days, containers were wooden. So, you know, freight containers. So mm-hmm. Just had a freight container with all their stuff. And I think seven of the kids come over. There was 11 kids. Seven or eight or the kids came over.
Man, when you started talking about that freight container, I thought that was how they traveled. I'm like, well, let's just get ourselves in this freight container and head over.
But that's what the boys slept in when they first come to Australia.
Whoa.
Yeah, so they
that's rugged.
Yeah, they stayed in camps, you know, just migrant camps for a while until we settled in Orange, New South Wales. My grandparents scraped up enough money for a bit of land, but it had no house on it. Mm-hmm. And it had a shed for some reason. So the girls stayed in the shed and the boys stayed in the freight container, which then arrived later from Europe. So anyway.
Wow.
That's the story of that.
That's pretty impressive that you know the whole story. And would they tell you this a lot when you were a kid? And you didn't, like, they didn't have the freight container still somewhere around. Like, this is how we got here. But it wasn't.
No, because, you know, they had to then build a house. You know, so, but Dad never spoke of anything at all. He was quite a stoic fellow. He was like, passes in the past.
But he worked in a psychiatric hospital, so he had to have been empathetic or somewhat compassionate, right, to work there.
Yeah, he was. He'd done a lot of jobs. He'd done that for a while, and then he had to get out before he went mad. And then he went around and done a lot of different salesman jobs, and then he came back to it in his 50s. But he unfortunately died when he was 59, so which back then was fair. You know,
he wasn't stricken like uncharacteristically young, even though by today's standards it would be.
But for these days, if you heard of someone dying at 59, it's like, oh, you know, too soon.
Right, right.
But, you know, that was back in the early 90s. So, he came back to being a psych nurse, something which I'm now looking at.
Really? So, well, let's talk about what you do now, because it's pretty unique. I mean, a couple of the videos, it seemed to me like, it almost seems like you work in a place that has like it's like a big barn with a bunch of animals that you breed and look after and care for and feed. And then you also have these fish that you're breeding. And how did you get into this whole world? And tell me, like, how accurate that assessment is, or is it way, I don't know what you do exactly.
No, you're spot on with everything, even the barn. It's about a 100-year-old building. I can't accurately date the building just at this point in time, but it's about 100 years old.
Isn't that weird? I was just in the United States is a lot of times that way too. Like, well, I don't know the exact origin of the barn. And maybe because it wasn't set to by someone with a lot of power. Like I was just in Europe. And every building, they know exactly when it was built and who said to build it for them and why. And they're, you know, 1,500 years old. And then we have things that are 80 or 100 years old, and people are like, yeah, no one knows when it was built. And it's probably just because someone built it out of need and not because some jerk who later became someone on a horse statue told them to.
Yes, all these things get lost a little bit, but I'm sure if I dug enough in the local council, I would find something.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this famous, locally famous picture of Orange, a panoramic picture which shows almost every building. It was taken from the tallest structure in town at that stage, which was, you would think it would be a church, but it wasn't. It was a local mill, and you can see where the shed is, but it's obscured by another taller building. So I think that's 1904. So it's just it's a bit annoying that it can't be seen.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's about 100 years old.
Okay, sorry. So I interrupted you. About 100 years old, this big. And I will say, just from looking at the video I saw, it doesn't look that old. It's pretty looks pretty spacious and modern.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really nice old building. The concrete floor was added later, and it's got some really, really nice beams in there. It's a nice building. It's just something I rent. But I put my fish room in there, which is a polycarbonate greenhouse to protect the heating for the tropical fish, because this is a pretty cold area for Australia, so a lot of money can go out on heating. So I put all the fish in a greenhouse, and then we've got the rabbits and the guinea pigs and that we breed, and birds, pet birds that I don't breed so much these days, but I used to. But I'm mainly a fish guy, you can say, when it comes to we call each other.
It seems like you have a vast knowledge, like working knowledge, of how these, when their season is, when they should be breeding, how to keep them, what temperature at. Like when you said polycarbonate, does that mean like the material that the green room is made from?
Yeah, it's, I think it's something NASA come up with. Something like that, because they thought, oh, this would be good to make a space elevator out of. But I might be connecting two totally disparate things. But anyway, I heard about it about 10 years ago, and I thought, oh, that'll be fantastic, because, you know, making glass out of glass is such a stupid thing, because it doesn't have any give, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Glass isn't, unless you make it very thick, which is heavy and expensive and all that sort of thing. So I thought, oh, this will be a great new thing. But the first thing they seem to be using the polycarbonate for is greenhouses, because if you have a big hailstorm, you know, the glass, not only does it get smashed, but it's quite dangerous. So polycarbonate greenhouses have really sprung up all over the landscape, because food production is, you know, becoming more and more important because of all the people we've got, Dave. Humanitis.
We've got a lot of those people. So your fish are about as safe as they can get. They're in a barn, and then they're in this hard plastic material inside of that that insulates them to some degree and keeps the temperature reasonable. And then you're a fish guy. Even though you know, like, hey, that guinea pig's in heat, you could throw little stud baby Dave in there and he'd crank out some smaller guinea pigs or babies. But how do you do it with a fish?
Well, fish are pretty much up for it sex-wise if they're mature. But it's just a case of getting the conditions right. It's one of the easiest fish to breed would be the guppy. I'm sure you've heard of them.
Yeah, we used to catch guppies. I think the idea was to put them in a bigger tank, let them grow to be enormous, and then feed ourselves, but that never worked.
It's just something you and your sister came up with.
Yeah, and my cousin. We would we'd spend a lot of time walking around hunched over with our, like, you know, in like knee-deep water, just slowly tracking guppies and then trying to catch them in our hands. It does feel kind of cool when you scoop them out. I don't even know if we ever took any home. I think it was such an idiotic idea, but it seemed reasonable.
Well, guppies are great because they come in a wide range of colors, you know, your domestic guppies. They're pretty easy to keep as far as temperature and water, you know, parameters of water requirements. And, you know, they're sexually mature at, you know, a few weeks, and not mature, but sexually active. And, you know, as soon as the females can become pregnant, they do, because the males are very, very keen in that area. And then, you know, a really young female might only have, you know, 6 or 7 babies. They have them live every month. So every 28 or so days, they'll have a brood. But, you know, big broods can go up to, you know, to sort of 60, 80, something like that. So they have live babies and they can't really help it, the females. And sort of.
What does that look like? 80?
Yeah. It's wondrous the first time it happens because you'll be watching this female, watching her getting fatter and fatter, and you'll say, okay, well, I'll put her in a little trap because not only do the females eat their own babies, but everyone else will eat their babies. So you put her in a little trap to where as soon as the babies are born, they go down into a section where the female can't get to them. And
No, there's a fence there. You can't eat your children. Nice try.
That's I don't breed them that way now. I breed them free range.
Would she just fill up? I mean, would she eat, what, 15? And then be like, all right, I'm good. And then you'd say, well, we're going to take the rest. Like, but I wanted to eat some more later. Or would she eat all 80 in one sitting?
No, she'll the first one. Yeah, she'll eat 10 or 12 and then the second one, she'll go back for more later.
Wow.
But it only takes 3-4 days until they're, you know, sort of too big to eat.
That, from her standpoint, though, sorry to jump in.
No, you're right.
Just thinking about that imagine if you're hungry and you know that you're about to just out of nowhere create so much food, like more than you could possibly eat. That has to be a good feeling for her. And then so frustrating when you put in that fence and she doesn't get them. And she's like, but I'm starving.
Well, see, this is the real point about fish that you got to remember is on the scale of intelligence, they haven't got much.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Some of the most intelligent, you know, aquarium fish. I'm just talking about aquarium fish. I don't know about all fish around the world, and certainly there's a lot of sea fish that are a bit smarter than a lot of the freshwater ones we put in tanks. But, you know, they're not real bright. And so they don't really do a lot of thinking. Probably the most you can hope out of freshwater aquarium fish is that they recognize you, that you're food guy. Mm-hmm. You know, they wouldn't even know you as Dave. Just food guy. But if you fed them every day, they would know your form, your head shape over your girlfriend's head shape.
Hmm.
So if your girlfriend was feeding while you were away, I know you go away most months, they would be less excited in seeing her than when food guy came back. Main food guy.
Main food guy. They grow a little bit attached to main food guy.
Yeah, they do. They really know the shape of your body and all that sort of stuff.
Do you get somewhat attached to them, or do you look at them like just idiotic pieces of, like, I guess they're sort of a decoration for you, like exotic fish would be just to be in an aquarium. They're just something to look at.
I think there's sort of three ways to look at fish is, first of all, they're a living thing, so you got to treat them with respect.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, they're worth money and they take money to maintain, so that's another way to look at it with respect. If you paid, you know, you can pay hundreds of dollars for an aquarium of fish, but the average one would only be a few dollars. But it doesn't make a lot of financial sense to then just let that die without putting in the appropriate effort.
Right.
So, you know, a second way to look at it, and a third way to look at it is, you know, they're just pretty.
Are you a vegetarian?
I'm a pescatarian, actually. Fish is the only meaty thing I do eat.
But not your own fish.
No, I wouldn't do that, Dave. What have you heard?
Well, I mean, say you find one of them not doing great and you look after it for a bit and then pretty soon it's floating. You're like, well, I don't want this to go to waste. Did you ever try it out?
Absolutely not. I'm against eating pets on all levels.
But you just said they're not really pets because they're so dumb.
Yeah, no, I don't really consider them pets. I consider them more as livestock. Yeah, but I mean, I don't think I'd eat my own livestock either.
I can see that. Yeah, I sometimes enjoy the idea of having, you know, some animals around and just knowing where my food comes from. But I think if I had a few cows or sheep or pigs or whatever, I would just start to like them. I'm like, well, you can stay around. You're pretty cool. So it'd be hard for me to feed myself, I guess.
I think, you know, you spend time around animals and they sort of seep into your consciousness. So even if it's like, a few calves that you're raising up to send to, you know, to send to market, don't eat those ones. But I'm okay. I've taken myself out of it because I don't really consider fish meat. I consider it fish, and not real bright.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they're a good source of protein for people because, you know, we see cattle and chickens and pigs being treated so terribly all the time. You can put on the blinders about that, but it's still going to be true.
Yeah.
It doesn't take away the facts, but you cannot worry about it if you like. Sheep are a bit different. I don't see them being kept in the same sort of ways, but why just eat lamb? I don't know. Why not just wipe out the whole thing, wipe out the whole equation?
Well, yeah, everyone's got their own thoughts on that, and they're vast.
I don't mind what other people do. I only care what I do.
Yeah, if you went over to someone's house and they had a lamb just in a tiny little crate and they were putting gum in its wall and whistling at it really loudly and just being jerks, you'd be like, hey, I wish you wouldn't have lamb and I wish you wouldn't eat it. You're the worst. And that's one of the only scenarios I can think of where I'd be frustrated with how someone got their food. Mostly the gum in the wall. That's just it's mean.
Yeah, and lamb whistling at.
Yeah, why you whistle at them? Let them hang out. But you're right, they do more often tend to get like some free time out in a field, and then they're pretty dumb.
No one likes a whistler.
Yeah, no one likes.
When I was working in supermarkets when I was a young lad, and you'd get the old guys who would come in with the really tuneless whistling and loud just all the way across the supermarket, I would say to workmates, we've got a whistler.
Yeah, there is probably the most annoying thing, well, other than people popping their gum. I don't know why those both popped up in my scenario, the gum and the whistling, but they are, when people do that, like, it drives me crazy. They have no awareness that anyone else might be around and might not enjoy that, don't like their particular tune that they are whistling. It's infuriating. I wish
there's
something
really
we could do.
Good professional whistlers, and I think, you know, leave it up to the professionals.
Yeah, I guess like if Andrew Bird was walking through whistling, you'd be like, well, that's actually kind of nice. But someone just whistling just for the sake of it, just to be a whistle guy, I've had it. And I think a lot of times, never mind. They're just...
fish don't whistle. It like doesn't matter.
Yeah, you've got a pretty nice deal there. Like, how'd you get in? How long have you been doing it? And how many fish do you try to sell, like, per month? And where do you get them?
How long have I been into it? I guess I was about 11 or 12 when I got into aquarium keeping, but I was quite enamored with fish before that. Grandparents used to have fish. My uncle was a big fish guy back in the sort of 60s when it wasn't easy.
My uncle's a big fish guy back when it wasn't easy.
Yeah.
All right,
Uncle,
sorry.
Uncle Bill, he used to build his own tanks and his own filters and stuff like that. I remember going around his place and seeing his sort of antique setups and thinking, wow. But I was only a really, really young man then. And then a neighbor down the road, this is a really complicated story, but anyway, he was a brother of a good friend of my brother's.
Okay.
So anyway, let's go see what insert name here is up to. And I said, yeah, sure, let's walk on down. It's only four houses. Walked on down there, and his whole lounge room was just fish tanks and a lounge and a TV. He was right into it, and because it was prophetic, because my lounge room ended up the same way. I was like, wow. And then, you know, I was just absolutely amazed with all the different types of fish. He kept a really good wide range of fish, some big ones, some small ones.
Is that important? If you're going to cultivate fish, you can't just be the best at the orange guys. You got to have a variety. Long fins, the wavy ones. Oh,
Dave, you're a sweet kid. Yeah. I mean, you know, the fish guys, they get right into it and they get quite obsessed. There's clubs, there's societies.
Really?
You know, there's Facebook groups and there's a lot of conjecture between species, who's the best at this, who's the best at that.
Are there like fish shows?
Yeah, not so much in Australia because of our small population. We don't have too many, but most of the societies do have them. The Germans are really big on fish.
They should be cut out of all things that involve selective breeding. Am I right? They shouldn't be allowed in any competitions there.
Fish and selective breeding, that's how we do it, yeah.
They should disallow Germans. It just seems creepy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems weird that the Germans would be the top guys in controlling organisms and selective breeding, but they're probably the best.
So they're good, and then you guys sort of pine away that you can't even go match your abilities against them because you'd have to be so expensive to transport your fish. And yet you must sit there and just be like, yeah, if they only saw how good we are. The Australians were the best and we're trapped here. We can't go show our skills off to the rest of the world at breeding fish. And not to minimize what you're doing, but it does seem like on the very fringe end of, if you like make a cake, people can look at it, taste it. It seems completely arbitrary that you would select which one is the best, but we have some sort of inclination to do that with virtually everything. But fish seems like such an odd one. I mean, how can you really look at it and objectively go, man, that guy grows the best fish?
Well, it's because you get in the clubs, your interest broadens out. Because, you talk to Jim, and Jim's got the best electric blue cichlids. You should see them. And so, well, I've bred a few electric blue cichlids in my time. So, so then you have a look at pictures these days with the rise of the internet. And, in the olden days, you'd go over to Jim's because people just open their doors to people. And you have a look at Jim's, and then because you've used your brain to take mental pictures of yours, and then Jim's, and then you can say, is Jim the victor, or how would you tell just as good? Well, it's just shades of blue in this case, because electric blue cichlids, they're a really, really almost fluorescent electric blue with a red anal fin and a lighter metallic blue stripe going up their snout over their dorsal. So that's the first things that you're looking for, because fish hybridize a lot too, so you get hybrids.
Yeah.
And many of the times I've had to, email or call suppliers and say, look, you're giving me hybrids here. I'm not happy. There's spots where spots shouldn't be. And I've had quite a few arguments on society forums about, guys selling things as whatnot, as they're not true to the wild form. And, a few arguments. Sort of had to use that voice like, au contraire, mon frère, females of this species does not have spots there, sorry.
So they're in the game. I mean, they, for me, if someone was coming in doing that, I would be blown away. Like, who is this dude that knows these fish are hybrids? I'm just selling fish. But you're dealing with people who should know. And so they're being a bit unethical.
Yes. Well, exactly right. So you got the two people, the people who don't know and the people who know. So the people who know, you can come down quite hard upon. But the people who don't know, I was speaking to a young lady the other day. She'd crossed two types of catfish and was rather pleased with herself because the fish that come out of that breeding were very pretty. I said, I agree with you, they're very pretty, but they should all be destroyed.
And, well, now you're being, I mean, whew, we could get into a whole thing here because you're being so staunch in the way things should look. So are you someone that wouldn't like, say, like a labradoodle or something like that?
No, different, because they're not endangered. A lot of fish species are endangered in the wild, or they're potentially endangered. If you look at species of fish that come out of Africa, it's one of the more politically, we all know about the Middle East, but there's not very many fish there. So if we looked at Africa, we could say, oh, you know, there's borders are changing and there's a lot of activity over the last 30 years there politically. If we don't hold on to this species, next time we go to collect some, it might be barred by that government, which happens all the time. They're changing, you know, they're changing their rules and regulations on these things.
So you guys, as the fish community at large in the world, you'll recognize these things and go, man, I don't care who wins that war, just as long as whoever is next in power keeps focus on our fish, you know, initiative. We've got to protect these fish.
Yeah, well, we do think about it. And the New South Wales Aquarium Society, then they started up a program to protect species that were endangered in Australia that we thought might be tricky to import, because Australia's got quite a narrow band of what you can import, because we've got tropical areas, subtropical areas. We've got a lot of good fish areas for tropical fish. So if they get out and get feral, it can be a problem, you know, like, you know, carp have and guppies. Guppies in...
So you and one of your fish buddies could go rogue and go release some fish, say, into the ocean and really wreak havoc.
Well, this is what happens. I mean, not so much in the ocean, because even, you know, for saltwater species, it's quite inhospitable.
Oh, sure, yeah, you're doing freshwater.
Yeah, but in freshwater, because they're smaller, more controllable bodies of water, I mean, this happens quite regularly. You hear about fish popping up in where they shouldn't be, in lakes and rivers and dams and stuff like that, and the government eventually gets around to eradicating them, which is good.
That's got to be frustrating,
though. Because we don't want another, you know, European carp scenario, because that's obviously terrible.
If only they were as effective with the foxes and rabbits as they are with your fish.
Well, foxes are running rampant. The rabbits we've got a hold on due to a couple of diseases that have been released, myxomatosis and the Khaleesi virus. You know, the diseases mutate a little bit every so often, and you know when the and so that helps keep the rabbits under control.
Oh, okay. Well, I wanna get more into like the breeding and the real nuts and bolts. Yes, I meant all those words right when we we'll take a little break here and then come back and do that. How's that sound, Daniel?
Sure. More fun with fish.
Okay, great. Good guy, isn't he? Fun to chat with. Must have been weird for him and is weird for him currently. This is very meta that he edited this, and yet he listened to this, and it is listening to it prior to anyone else and putting it together, and that has to be kind of a trip. So, Dan, I hope it is as enjoyable as it was to chat with him, and there more next week. We get deeper into the guppy game, and he also sent me along a video, like 40 minutes long, of a guppy show. It's pretty riveting. So, yeah, really enjoyed chatting with Dan. Again, Planet 9, big news. Hope you guys are excited about that. Curious what your thoughts are on what it should be named. Thanks to Ambrose and Steven for writing in some questions to ask Matthew when I chatted with him. I didn't ask him really any of the questions because one that Steven asked was whether it had moons. Too far off to tell. We can't see really enough to really know that. And Ambrose asked if that was going to be the current or the permanent name. It doesn't seem like it's going to be. So especially if we get our movement for Planet Bowie going, we could really make a dent. And I think that would be cool. All right, guys, let's get out of here. You can find the show a lot of places on the internet. And if there's somewhere that you can't find it and you're listening through maybe the website and you'd rather have an easier way to have it shipped right to your phone, let me know. And I'll try to get that platform established. Thanks for rating it and subscribing and all those dumb things. You can stream, I don't know how much longer I'll keep it up there, but for now, One-Headed Beast is on Vimeo. It's an animated stand-up special I made. I would love it if you watched it, and it's different, and it's that's all I can say. It's just a little different as a stand-up special. I hope you'll watch it. Let's get out of here, you guys, with some music. Thanks again to Dan, engineering the show. Thanks to Kim Bowman for helping out with guests and things like that. Thanks to Rob Crow for the sound and the theme song at the beginning. And let's leave you with a little bit more sound and music from Zach in Phoenix, Yojimbo Billions. This is Final Voyage from the album Our Bodies Are Machines. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave.